He would not, under any ordinary circumstances, pay heed to the invitation implicit in Mrs. Hacklett's words. There was much to do in this last day before the Cassandra set sail, but he was required to go to the inland anyway to see Blackeye, if there was time. He shrugged and went to the stables to get his horse. Chapter 9. The Jew was ensconced in Sutter's Bay, to the east of the port. Even from a distance, Hunter could determine his location by the acrid smoke rising above the green trees and the occasional report of explosive charges. He rode into a small clearing and found the Jew in the midst of a bizarre scene. Dead animals of all sorts lay everywhere, stinking in the hot midday sun. Three wooden casks containing saltpeter, charcoal, and sulfur stood to one side. Fragments of broken glass lay glinting in the tall grass. The Jew himself was working feverishly, his clothing and face smeared with blood and the dust of exploded powder. Hunter dismounted and looked around him. "What in God's name have you been doing?"
"What you asked," Black Eye said. He smiled. "You will not be disappointed. Here, I will show you. First, you gave me the task of a long and slow-burning fuse, yes?"
Hunter nodded.
"The usual fuses are of no use," the Jew said judiciously. "One could employ a powder trail, but it burns with great swiftness. Or contrarywise, one could employ a slow match."
A slow match was a piece of cord or twine soaked in saltpeter.
"But that is very slow indeed, and the flame is often too weak to ignite the final materials. You take my meaning?"
"I do."
"Well then, an intermediate flame and speed of burning is provided by increasing the proportion of sulfur in the powder. But such a mixture is notorious for its unreliability. One does not wish the flame to sputter and die."
"No."
"I tried many soaked strings and wicks and cloths to no avail. None can be counted on. Therefore, I searched for a container to hold the charge. I have found this."
He held up a thin, white, stringy substance.
"The entrails of a rat," he said, smiling happily. "Lightly dried over warm coals to remove humors and juices yet retaining flexibility. So, now when a quantity of powder is introduced to the intestine, a serviceable fuse results. Let me show you."
He took one length of intestine, perhaps 10 feet long, whitish, with the faint dark appearance of the powder inside. He set it down on the ground and lit one end. The fuse burned quietly, with little sputtering, and it was slow, consuming no more than an inch or two in the space of a minute. The Jew smiled broadly.
"You see?"
"You have reason to be proud," Hunter said. "Can you transport this fuse?"
"With safety," the Jew said. "The only problem is time. If the intestine becomes too dry, it is brittle and may crack. This will happen after a day or so."
"Then we must carry a quantity of rats with us."
"I believe as much," the Jew said. "Now I have a further surprise, something you did not request. Perhaps you cannot find a use for it, though it seems to me a most admirable device."
He paused.
"You have heard of the French weapon which is called the grenadeau?"
"No," Hunter shook his head. "A poisoned fruit?"
"Grenadeau was the French word for pomegranate, and poisoning was lately very popular in the court of Louis." "In a sense," the Jew said with a slight smile, "it is so called because of the seeds within the pomegranate fruit. I have heard this device exists, but was dangerous to manufacture. Yet I have done so. The trick is the proportion of saltpeter. Let me show you."
The Jew held up an empty, small-necked glass bottle. As Hunter watched, the Jew poured in a handful of birdshot and a few fragments of metal. While he worked, the Jew said,
"I do not wish you to think ill of me. Do you know of the Complicidad Grande?"
"Only a little."
"It began with my son." the Jew said, grimacing as he prepared the grenadeau. In August of the year 1639, my son had long renounced the faith of a Jew. He lived in Lima, in Peru, in New Spain. His family prospered. He had enemies. He was arrested on the 11th of August. The Jew poured more shot into the glass and charged with being a secret Jew. It was said he would not make a sale on a Saturday, and also that he would not eat bacon for his breakfast. He was branded a Judaizer. He was tortured. His bare feet were locked into red-hot iron shoes and his flesh sizzled. He confessed. The Jew packed the glass with powder and sealed it with dripping wax. He was imprisoned for 6 months, he continued. In 1640, in January, 11 men were burned at the stake. 7 were alive. One of them was my son. Cazalla was the garrison commander who supervised the execution of the auto. My son's property was seized. His wife and children disappeared. The Jew glanced briefly at Hunter and wiped away the tears in his eyes. I do not grieve, he said, but perhaps you will understand this. He raised the grenadeau and inserted a short fuse. You had best take cover behind those bushes, the Jew said. Hunter hid and watched as the Jew set the bottle on a rock, lit the fuse, and ran madly to join him. Both men watched the bottle. What is to happen? Hunter said. Watch, the Jew said, smiling for the first time. A moment later, the bottle exploded. Flying glass and metal blasted out in all directions. Hunter and the Jew ducked to the ground, hearing the fragments tear through the foliage above them. When Hunter raised his head again, he was pale. Good God, he said. Not the gentleman's apparatus, the Jew said. It causes little damage to anything more solid than flesh. Hunter looked at the Jew curiously. The Don has earned such attentions, the Jew said. What is your opinion of the grenadeau? Hunter paused. His every instinct rebelled against a weapon so inhumane. Yet he was taking 60 men to capture a treasure galleon in an enemy stronghold. 60 men against a fortress with 300 soldiers and the crew ashore, making another 200 or 300. Build me a dozen, he said. Box them for the voyage and tell no one. They shall be our secret. The Jew smiled. You shall have your revenge, Don Diego, Hunter said. Then he mounted his horse and rode off. Chapter 10. Crawford's Valley was a pleasant half-hour ride to the north, through the lush green foliage at the foot of the Blue Mountains. Hunter arrived at a high ridge overlooking the valley, and saw the horses of Mrs. Hacklett and her 2 slaves tied alongside the gurgling stream, which ran out from the rocky pool at the east edge of the valley. He also saw a picnic cloth spread and food laid out. He rode down to the horses and tied up his own. It took only a moment for him to bribe the 2 black women, pressing a finger to his lips and tossing them a shilling. Giggling to themselves, the 2 women slipped away. This was not the first time either of them had been bribed to keep silent about a clandestine meeting, and Hunter had no concern that they might tell anyone what they had seen. Nor did he think they would not soon be peering through the bushes at the 2 white people and cackling to themselves. He moved quietly along the rocks by the edge of the pool, at the base of a gentle waterfall. Mrs. Hacklett was splashing about in the waters of the spring. She had not noticed Hunter yet. Sarah, Mrs. Hacklett said, speaking to the slave she still thought was nearby, do you know that Captain Hunter in the port?
Mm-hmm,
Hunter said, in a high-pitched voice. He sat down next to her clothes. Robert says he is naught but a common rogue and pirate, she said. But Robert pays me so little attention. Since I was the favorite of the king, now there is a merry man and no mistake. But this Captain Hunter, he is so handsome. Does he have the favors of many women in the town, do you know? Hunter did not answer. He watched Mrs. Hacklett splashing. I expect he must do. He has that look in his eye which melts the hardest heart. And he is obviously strong and brave. No woman could fail to notice that. And his fingers and nose are of goodly length, which bodes well for his attentions. Does he have a favorite in the town, Sarah? Hunter did not answer. His Majesty has long fingers, and he is wonderfully well suited for the bedroom, she giggled. I should not be saying this, Sarah. Hunter still said nothing. Sarah, she said, turning, and she saw Hunter, sitting there grinning at her. Don't you know it is unhealthy to bathe? Hunter said. She splashed about angrily. All that has been spoken of you is true, she complained. You are a dastardly, uncouth, utterly foul man, and truly no gentleman. Were you expecting a gentleman today? She splashed more. Certainly I expected more than a common sneak and thief. Leave this spot now, so that I may dress myself. I find this spot most amiable, Hunter said. You refuse to leave? She was very angry. In the clear water, Hunter could see that she was rather too thin for his taste, a small-breasted, bony woman with a pinched face, but her anger aroused him. Indeed, I fear I do refuse. Then, sir, I have misjudged you. I thought you would extend common courtesy and ordinary good manners to a woman at disadvantage. What is your disadvantage? Hunter asked. I am plainly naked, sir. So I see. And this spring is cold. Is it? It is indeed. You have just perceived this? Sir, I shall ask you once more to cease this impertinence and allow me a moment's privacy to dry and clothe myself. In reply, Hunter walked down to the edge of the water, took her hand, and hauled her onto the rock, where she stood dripping and shivering despite the warmth of the sun. She glared at him. "You'll catch your death of chill," he said, grinning at her discomfiture. "Then let us be equal," she said, and abruptly pushed him, fully clothed, into the water. He landed with a splash and felt a shock as the icy water touched his body. It made him gasp for breath. He floundered about while she stood on the rock, laughing at him. "Madam," he said, struggling. "Madam, I beseech you." She continued to laugh. "Madam," he said, "I cannot swim. I pray you to help." And his head bobbed under water a moment. "A seafaring man who cannot swim?" And she laughed more. "Madam," was all he could say as he came to the surface, then sank again. A moment later, he struggled up, splashing and kicking with no coordination, and she looked at him with concern. She reached out her hand, and he kicked and sputtered toward her. He took her hand and pulled hard, flinging her high over his head. She screamed loudly and landed flat on her back with a stinging slap. She shrieked again as she went under. He laughed when she came to the surface and helped her out onto the warm rock. "You are nothing," she sputtered, "but a bastard, a rogue, a cutthroat, vicious, rascally, whoreson scoundrel." "At your service," Hunter said, and kissed her. She broke away. "And forward." "And forward," he agreed, and kissed her again. "I suppose you intend to rape me like a common street woman." "I doubt," Hunter said, stripping off his wet clothing, "that it will be necessary." And it was not. "In daylight?" she said, in a horrified voice, and those were her last intelligible words. Chapter 11. In the middle of the day, Mr. Robert Hacklett confronted Sir James Almont with disturbing news. "The town is rife with rumor," he said, "that Captain Hunter, the same man with whom we supped yesterday past, is now organizing a piratical expedition against a Spanish dominion, perhaps even Havana." "You place credence in these tales?" Almont asked calmly. "Your Excellency," Hacklett said, "it is a simple fact that Captain Hunter has caused to have provisions for a sea voyage put aboard his sloop Cassandra.
Probably, Almont said. What proof is that of crime?
Your Excellency, Hacklett said, with the greatest respect, I must inform you that by rumor, you have countenanced this excursion, and indeed may have made pecuniary gestures of support.
Do you mean I paid for the expedition? Almont said, a little irritably.
In words to that effect, Sir James.
Sir James sighed. Mr. Hacklett, he said, when you have resided here a little longer, let us say perhaps a week, you will come to know that it is always the rumor that I have countenanced an excursion and have paid for it.
Then the rumors are groundless?
To this extent, I have given papers to Captain Hunter authorizing him to engage in logwood cutting at any convenient place. That is the extent of my interest in the matter.
And where shall he cut this logwood?
I've no notion, Almont said. Probably the Mosquito Coast of Honduras. That is the ordinary place.
Your Excellency, Hacklett persisted,
may I respectfully remind you that in this era of peace between our nation and Spain, the cutting of logwood represents an irritant which might easily be avoided? You may so remind me, Almont said, but I judge you to be incorrect. Many lands in these parts are claimed by Spain, and yet they have no habitation, no town, no colonists, no citizenry on these lands. In the absence of such proofs of dominion, I find the cutting of logwood to be unobjectionable.
Your Excellency, Hacklett said, can you not agree that what begins as a logwood-cutting expedition, even granting the wisdom of what you say, may easily turn into a piratical venture?
Easily? Not easily, Mr. Hacklett.
To His Most Sacred Majesty Charles, by the grace of God, of Great Britain and Ireland, King, Defender of the Faith, etc. The humble petition of the Deputy Governor of His Majesty's Plantations and Lands in Jamaica, in the West Indies. Humbly, sheweth, that I, Your Majesty's most loyal subject, having been charged by Your Majesty with the promulgation of the Court's feelings and desires on the matter of piratical ventures in the West Indies, and having made known by delivery of epistle and oral pronouncement to Sir James Almont, Governor of the aforementioned land of Jamaica, these same feelings and desires, I must report that little attention is given to the cessation and suppression of piracy in these parts. On the contrary, I must sadly, if honestly, state that Sir James himself consorts with all manner of rogue and villain, that he encourages by word, deed, and coin the continuance of dastardly and bloody raids on Spanish lands, that he permits use of Port Royal as a common meeting place for these cutthroats and knaves, and for the dispersal of their ill-gotten gains, that he shows no remorse for these activities and no evidence of their future cessation, that he is himself a man unsuited to high capacity by virtue of poor health and lax moral outlook, that he abides all manner of corruption and vice in the name of His Majesty. For all these reasons and proofs, I most humbly implore and petition Your Majesty to remove this man from his position, and to choose, in His Majesty's great wisdom, a more suitable successor who shall not daily make a mockery of the crown. I most humbly implore Your Majesty's royal assent to this simple petition, and shall ever pray. In that continuance I am, Your most faithful, loyal, and obedient servant, Robert Hacklett. God save the King.
Hacklett reread the letter once, found it satisfactory, and rang for the servant. Anne Sharp answered his call.
"Child," he said, "I wish you to see that this letter is dispatched on the next boat to England."
And he gave her a coin.
"My lord,"
she said, with a little curtsy.
"Treat it with care," Hacklett said, frowning at her.
She slipped the coin into her blouse.
"Does my lord wish anything else?" Eh?
He said, somewhat surprised. The saucy girl was licking her lips, smiling at him. No, he said tersely. Be gone now. She left. He sighed. Chapter 12. By torchlight, Hunter supervised the loading of his ship long into the night. Wharfage fees in Port Royal were high. An ordinary merchant vessel could not afford to dock for more than a few hours to load or unload a cargo. But Hunter's little sloop Cassandra spent fully 12 hours drawn up to the pilings, and Hunter was not charged a penny. On the contrary, Cyrus Pitkin, who owned the dock, expressed delight at offering Hunter the space, and, to further encourage the captain to take up the generous offer, provided him with 5 free casks of water. Hunter was polite in his acceptance. He knew that Pitkin was not being truly magnanimous. He would expect some gift on the Cassandra's return, and he would get it. Similarly, he accepted a barrel of salt pork from Mr. Oates, a farmer on the island. And he accepted a keg of powder from Mr. Renfrew, the gunsmith. It was all done with elaborate courtesy and a sharp eye to value received and expected. In between these courtly exchanges, Hunter questioned each member of his crew, and he had Mr. Enders examine them for disease to be sure they were sound of body before they were allowed to board. Hunter also checked all the provisions, opening each barrel of pork and water, sniffing the contents, then plunging his hand to the bottom to be certain it was filled all the way down. He tasted each cask of water, and he satisfied himself that the stores of hard biscuit were fresh and without weevils. On a long ocean voyage, it was not possible for the captain to make such examinations himself. An ocean voyage called for literally tons of food and water for the passengers, and much of the meat was taken on live, squawking and mooing. But privateers traveled differently. Their small boats were crammed with men, and provisioning was slight. A privateer did not expect to eat well on a voyage. Sometimes, in fact, no food at all was taken on, and the vessel set out with the expectation of obtaining provisions by raiding another ship or a town. Nor were the privateers heavily armed. The Cassandra, a sloop of 70 feet, carried 4 Sakers, swivel-mounted guns positioned fore and aft. These were its only armament, and they were hardly suited against even a 5th- or 6th-rate warship. Instead, the privateers relied on speed and maneuverability, and a shallow draft, to elude their more dangerous opponents. They could sail closer to the wind than a larger warship, and they could make for shoal harbors and channels where a bigger ship could not continue pursuit. In the Caribbean Sea, where they were hardly ever out of sight of some island with its protective ring of shoal coral reefs, they felt safe enough. Hunter worked at the loading of his ship until nearly dawn. From time to time, whenever curious onlookers gathered, he was careful to send them away. Port Royal was thick with spies. Spanish settlements paid well for advance news of an intended raid. And in any case, Hunter did not want people to see the unusual supplies he was laying in, all the rope, the grappling hooks, and the strange bottles the Jew had provided in cases. The Jew's cases, in fact, were stored in an oilskin sack and placed below decks, out of view of the seamen themselves. It was, as Hunter explained to Don Diego, our little secret. As dawn was breaking, Mr. Enders, still energetic, still bouncing with his lilting walk, came over and said, "Beg pardon, Captain, but there's a one-legged beggar's been lingering by the warehouse for the better part of the night." Hunter peered at the building, still dark in the early morning light. The docks were not a profitable place to beg. "You know him?" "No, Captain." Hunter frowned. Under other circumstances, he could send the man to the governor and request that the beggar be clapped in Marshalsea jail for a few weeks. But the hour was late. The governor was still sleeping and would not be pleased at a disturbance. "Bassa!" The huge form of the Moor materialized at his side. "You see the beggar with the wooden leg?" Bassa nodded. "Kill him." Bassa walked away. Hunter turned to Enders, who sighed. "It's best, I think, Captain," he repeated the old proverb. Better a voyage begin in blood than end in blood. I fear we may have plenty of both, Hunter said, and turned back to his work. When the Cassandra set sail a half hour later, with Lazoo forward to watch for the shoals of Pelican Point in the dim morning light, Hunter looked back once at the docks and the port. The town slept peacefully. The lamplighters were extinguishing the torches at the dock. A few well-wishers were turning away, having said their goodbyes. Then, floating face down in the water, he saw the body of the one-legged beggar. In the tide, the body rocked back and forth, the wooden leg knocking softly against a piling. It was, he thought, either a good omen or a bad one. He could not be certain which. Chapter 13
"Consorts with all manner of rogue and villain," sputtered Sir James. "Encourages the continuance of dastardly and bloody raids on Spanish lands. Good God, dastardly and bloody! The man is mad. Permits use of Port Royal as a common meeting place for these cutthroats and knaves. Unsuited to high capacity. Abides all manner of corruption. Damn the man!"
Sir James Almond, still in his dressing gown, waved the letter in his hand.
"Damn the rogue and villain," he said. "When did he give you this?"
"Yesterday, Your Excellency," Anne Sharp said. "I thought you would want it, Your Excellency."
"Indeed I do," Almond said, giving her a coin for her trouble. "And if there is more of the same, you shall be further rewarded, Anne."
He thought to himself that she was proving an exceedingly clever child.
"Has he made advances?"
"No, Your Excellency."
"As I thought," Almont said. "Well, we shall devise a way to settle Mr. Hacklett's games of intrigue once and finally."
He walked to the window of his bedchamber and looked out. In the early dawn light, the Cassandra, now rounding the point of Lime Key, raised her mainsail and headed east, gaining speed.
The Cassandra, like all privateering vessels, made first for Bull Bay, a little inlet a few miles east of Port Royal. There Mr. Enders put the ship into irons, and with sails luffing and fluttering in the light breeze, Captain Hunter made his speech. These formalities were known to everyone aboard. First, Hunter called for a vote on himself as captain of the vessel. A chorus of ayes greeted him. Then he stated the rules of the voyage: no drink, nor fornication, and no looting without his order, a penalty of death for breaking the rules. These were the usual rules, and the aye vote was perfunctory. Next, he explained the division of the booty. Hunter, as captain, would take 13 shares. Sanson would have 7. There was some grumbling at this figure. And Mr. Enders would have 1.5 shares. Lazoo would take 1.25. Black Eye would take 1.25. The rest would be equally distributed among the crew. One crew member stood.
"Captain, are you taking us to Matanceros? It is dangerous."
"Indeed it is," Hunter said, "but the booty is great. There will be plenty for every man. Any man who sees the danger as overmuch will be put ashore here in this bay, and none the worse, in my estimation. But he must go before I tell you the treasure that is there."
He waited. No one moved or spoke.
"All right," Hunter said. "Matanceros Harbor holds a Danish treasure, Neo. We are going to take her." At this, there was an enormous uproar among the crew. It was several minutes before Hunter could get them silent again, and when they looked back at him, he saw the glint in their eyes, fed by visions of gold.
"Are you with me?" Hunter shouted.
They responded with a shout.
"Then on to Matanceros!"
Part 2. The Black Ship. Chapter 14. Seen from a distance, the Cassandra presented a pretty spectacle. Her sails were taut in the morning breeze. She was heeled over a few degrees and cut a swift, hissing path through the clear blue water. On board the ship, however, it was cramped and uncomfortable. 60 fighting men, grizzled and smelly, jostled for space to sit, game, or sleep in the sun. They relieved themselves over the side without ceremony, and their captain was often presented with the spectacle of a half-dozen bare buttocks leaning over the leeward gunwale. No food was parceled out, and no water. None was given for the first day at all, and the crew, expecting this, had eaten and drunk their fill on their last night in port. Nor did Hunter anchor that evening. It was customary for the privateers to put into some protected cove to allow the crew to sleep ashore. But Hunter sailed straight through the first night. He had two reasons for haste. First, he feared spies who might make for Montanceros to warn the garrison there. And second, he did not wish to allow extra time, since the treasure Neo might depart the harbor of Montanceros at any time. At the end of the second day, they were beating northeast, through the dangerous passage between Hispaniola and Cuba. His crew knew this region well, for they were within a day's sail of Tortuga, long a pirate stronghold. He continued into the third day, and then landed for the night to rest his weary crew. The following day, he knew, would begin the long ocean run past Inagua, and then to Montanceros itself. There would be no safe landing in the future. Once they crossed latitude 20, they were in dangerous Spanish waters. His crew was in good spirits, laughing and joking around the campfires. During the past 3 days, only one man had been seized by visions of the crawling devils, which sometimes accompanied the absence of rum. That man was now calmer, no longer trembling and shaking. Satisfied, Hunter stared into the fire before him. Sanson came over and sat next to him.
What are your thoughts?
None special.
Do you brood on Cazala?
No, Hunter shook his head.
I know that he killed your brother,
Sanson said. He caused him to be killed, yes.
And this does not anger you?
Hunter sighed. Not anymore. Sanson stared at him in the flickering firelight.
What was the manner of his dying?
It is not important, Hunter said evenly. Sanson sat quietly for some moments.
I have heard, he said, that your brother was captured on a merchant ship by Cazala. I have heard that Cazala strung him up by his arms, cut off his testicles, and stuffed them into his mouth until he choked and died.
Hunter did not answer for some time. That is the story, he said finally.
And do you believe it?
Yes. Sanson scanned his face.
The crafty English. Where is your anger, Hunter?
I have it, Hunter said. Sanson nodded. He stood.
When you find Cazala, kill him quickly. Do not let this hatred cloud your brain.
My brain is not clouded.
No, I see it is not.
Sanson left. Hunter remained staring into the fire for a long time. In the morning, they entered the dangerous windward passage between Cuba and Hispaniola. Winds were unpredictable and the water was rough, but the Cassandra made excellent time. Sometime during the night, they passed the dark promontory of Limole, the westward tip of Hispaniola, to starboard. And near dawn, the profile of the land split to reveal Tortuga Island along the north coast. They continued on. They were in open water for all of the fourth day, but the weather was good, with only a light chop on the sea. By late afternoon, they sighted Inagua Island to port, and soon after, Lazoo spotted the crust on the horizon that meant Le Cake, dead ahead. This was important, for south of Le Cake was a treacherous shallow bank for several miles. Hunter gave orders to turn eastward toward the still unseen Turk Isles. The weather remained good. The crew sang and dozed in the sun. The sun was dropping lower in the sky when Lazoo electrified the sleeping crew with a shout, "Sail ho!" Hunter leapt to his feet. He squinted at the horizon, but saw nothing. Enders, the sea artist, had the glass to his eye, scanning in all directions.
"Damn me," he said,
and handed the glass to Hunter.
"She's hard abeam, Captain,"
Hunter looked through the spyglass. Through the curving rainbow rings of color, he saw a white rectangle low on the horizon. Even as he watched, the white rectangle took on another corner, becoming two overlapping rectangles. "How do you make it?" Enders asked. Hunter shook his head. "You know as well as I." From this distance, there was no way to determine the nationality of the approaching vessel, but these were undisputed Spanish waters. He glanced around the horizon. Inagua was far behind them. It would be a 5-hour sail, and that island offered few protections. To the north, Les Cakes were inviting, but the wind was out of the northeast, and they would have to be too close hauled to make good speed. To the east, Turk Isle was still not visible, and it was in the direction of the approaching sails. He had to make a decision. None of the alternatives were inviting. "Change course," he said finally. "Make for Les Cakes." Enders bit his lip and nodded. "Ready about!" he shouted, and the crew jumped to the halyards. The Cassandra came through the wind and tacked north. "Come off it," Hunter said, eyeing the sails. "Make speed." "Aye, Captain," Enders said. The sea artist was frowning unhappily, as indeed he might, for the sails on the horizon were now clearly visible to the naked eye. The other ship was gaining on them. The top gallant had now cleared the horizon, and the foresails were coming into view. With a glass to his eye, Hunter saw three corners to the top gallants. A 3-masted ship almost certainly meant a warship of some nationality. Damn! As he watched, the 3 sails merged into one square, then separated once more. "She's come about," Hunter said. "On a long reach now for us." Ender's feet did a little nervous dance while his hand gripped the tiller. "We'll not outrun her on this tack, Captain." "Or any tack," Hunter said gloomily. "Pray for a calm." The other ship was less than 5 miles away. In a steady wind, it would inexorably gain on the Cassandra. Their only hope now was a drop in the wind. Then the Cassandra's lighter weight would let her pull away. It sometimes happened that the wind died around sunset, but just as commonly, it freshened. Soon enough, Hunter felt the breeze more strongly on his cheeks. "We've no luck today," Enders said. They could now see the mainsails of the pursuing craft, pink in the sunset and billowing full in the freshened breeze. Les Cakes were still far away, a safe haven maddeningly distant, beyond their reach. "Shall we turn and run, Captain?" Enders asked. Hunter shook his head. The Cassandra might do better in a run before the wind, but that could only be postponing the inevitable. Unable to do anything, Hunter clenched his fists with impotent rage and watched the sails of the pursuing ship grow larger. They could see the edge of the hull now. "She's a ship of the line, all right," Enders said. "I can't make out the bow." The shape of the bow was the most likely way to tell nationality. Spanish warships tended to have blunter bow line than English or Dutch ships. Sanson came back to the tiller. "Are you going to fight?" he said. In answer, Hunter just pointed to the ship. The hull was now clear of the horizon. She was more than 130 feet at the waterline, and she had 2 gun decks. The gun ports were opened, the blunt snouts of the cannon protruding. Hunter did not bother to count them. There were at least 20, perhaps 30 on the starboard side that he could see. "She's donish to my eye," Sanson said. "So she is," Hunter agreed.
"Will you fight?"
"Fight that," Hunter said. Even as he spoke, the warship came around and fired an opening volley at the Cassandra. The guns were still too far away. The shots splashed harmlessly off the port side, but the warning was clear. Another 1,000 yards and the warship would be within range. Hunter sighed. "Come into the wind," he said softly.
"Beg pardon, Captain," Enders said.
"I said come into the wind and release all halyards."
"Aye, Captain," Enders said.
Sanson glared at Hunter and stomped off forward. Hunter paid no attention. He watched as his little sloop nosed into the wind, and the lines were let out. The sails luffed noisily in the breeze. The boat came to a standstill. Hunter's crew lined the port rail, watching as the warship came closer. The hull of the ship was painted entirely black, with gilt trim, the arms of Philip, prancing lions, shone on the aft castle. It was Spanish, all right.
"We could make a fair show," Enders said. "When they move in to take us, you've only to give us the word, Captain."
"No," Hunter said. On a ship of that size, there would be at least 200 sailors and as many armed soldiers on deck. 60 men in an open sloop against 400 in a larger craft. In the face of the least resistance, the warship would simply move off a distance and fire broadsides at the Cassandra until she sank.
"Better to die with a sword in your hands than a popish rope around your neck, or the Don's damned fire curling your toes," Enders said.
"We will wait," Hunter said.
"Wait for what?"
Hunter had no answer. He watched as the warship came so close that the shadow of the Cassandra's mainsail fell across her side. Spanish voices shouted staccato commands in the growing darkness. He looked at his own ship. Sanson was hurriedly priming pistols, jamming them into his belt. Hunter went over to him.
"I am going to fight," Sanson said. "You may give yourselves up like timid women, but I will fight."
Hunter had a sudden idea. "Then do this," he said, and whispered into Sanson's ear. A moment later, the Frenchman crept away. The Spanish shouts continued. Ropes were thrown to the Cassandra. An unbroken line of soldiers with muskets stood high above them on the warship's main deck, aiming down into the little sloop. The first of the Spanish soldiers climbed down to Cassandra. One by one, Hunter and his crew were prodded with muskets and forced to climb the rope ladder to the enemy vessel. Chapter 15. After they had spent so many days cramped aboard the Cassandra, the warship seemed enormous. Its main deck was so vast it appeared like a plain stretched out before them. Hunter's crew, hustled together by soldiers around the mainmast, the same crew that filled the sloop to overflowing, looked puny and insignificant here. Hunter looked at the faces of his men. They averted their eyes, not returning the gaze. Their expressions were angry, frustrated, disappointed. High above, the enormous sails fluttered in the breeze, making a noise so great that the dark Spanish officer confronting him had to shout to be heard.
"You are captain?"
he bellowed. Hunter nodded.
"What is called?"
"Hunter," he shouted back.
"English?"
"Yes."
"You go to this captain,"
the man said, and two armed soldiers hustled Hunter below. Apparently, he was to be taken to the captain of the warship. Hunter looked over his shoulder and had a last glimpse of his forlorn crew around the mast. Already their hands were being bound behind their backs. The warship's crew was efficient. He stumbled down the narrow stairs to the gun deck. He had a brief glimpse of the long line of cannon, their crews standing ready before he was roughly shoved aft. As he passed the open gun ports to aft, he could look down at his little sloop, tied alongside the warship. Spanish soldiers were swarming over it, and the Spanish sailors of the prize crew were examining its fittings and lines, preparing to sail it. He was not allowed to linger. A musket at his back prodded him along. They came to a door with two heavily armed, evil-looking men standing guard. Hunter noticed that these men wore no uniforms and assumed an air of peculiar superiority. They glanced at him with pitying disdain. One of them knocked on the door and said a few quick words in Spanish. There was an answering grunt, and they opened the door and pushed Hunter in. One of the guards went inside as well and closed the door. The captain's cabin was remarkably large and ornately fitted. There was evidence of space and luxury everywhere. There was a dining table with a fine linen cloth and gold plate set out for the evening meal by candlelight. There was a comfortable bed with a brocade bed cover laced in gold. A richly colored oil painting depicting Christ on the cross hung in a corner, above a cannon with an open porthole. In another corner, a lantern cast a warm golden light over the room. There was another table at the rear of the cabin. Maps covered it. Behind that table, in a plush red velvet chair, sat the captain himself. His back was turned to Hunter as he poured wine from a cut crystal decanter. Hunter could see only that the man was very large. His back was broad as a bull's.
"Well now," the captain said, in very good English, "can I persuade you to join me in a glass of this excellent claret?"
Before Hunter could reply, the captain turned. Hunter found himself staring into glowering eyes set in a heavy face with a strong nose and jet-black beard. Without his wishing, the words sprang from his lips.
"Cazala!"
The Spaniard laughed heartily.
"Did you expect King Charles?"
Hunter was speechless. He was vaguely aware that his lips worked, but no sound came out. At the same time, a thousand questions sprout to mind. Why was Cazala here, and not in Matanceros? Did that mean the galleon was gone? Or had he left the fortress in command of some capable lieutenant? Or perhaps he was ordered away by a higher authority? This warship might be bound for Havana. Even as these questions flooded his mind, he was overcome by a cold fear. It was all he could do to keep his body from shaking as he stood and looked at Cazala.
"Englishman," Cazala said, "your discomfort flatters me. I am embarrassed I do not know your name in turn. Sit down. Be at ease."
Hunter did not move. The soldier roughly shoved him into a chair facing Cazala.
"Much better," Cazala said. "Will you take your claret now?"
He passed Hunter the glass. With the strongest effort of will, Hunter kept his hand from trembling as he took the proffered glass. But he did not drink. He set it immediately on the table. Cazala smiled.
"Your health, Englishman," he said, and drank. "I must drink to your health while it is still possible to do so. You are not joining me? No? Come now, Englishman. Even His Excellency the commander of the Havana garrison does not have claret so fine as this. It is French, called Haute Brion. Drink."
He paused.
"Drink!"
Hunter took the glass and drank a little. He felt mesmerized, almost in a trance. But the taste of the claret broke the spell of the moment. The ordinary gesture of lifting the glass to his lips and swallowing brought him back to himself. His shock passed away, and he began to notice a thousand tiny details. He heard the breathing of the soldier behind him, probably 2 paces behind, he thought. He saw the irregularity of Cazala's beard and guessed the man had been some days at sea. He smelled the garlic on Cazala's breath as he leaned forward and said,
"Now, Englishman, tell me, what is your name?"
"Charles Hunter," he said, in a voice that was stronger and more confident than he had dared hope.
"Yes? Then I have heard of you. You are the same Hunter who took the Concepcion 1 season ago?"
"I am," Hunter said.
"The same Hunter who led the raid on Monte Cristo in Hispaniola and held the plantation owner Ramona for ransom?"
"I am."
"He is a pig, Ramona, do you not think?"
Cazala laughed.
"And you are also the same Hunter who captured the slave ship of De Reuters while it was at anchor in Guadeloupe and made off with all his cargoes?"
"I am."
"Then I am most pleased to be acquainted with you, Englishman. Do you know your value? No? Well, it has gone up each passing year, and perhaps it has been raised again. When last I heard, King Philip offered 200 gold doubloons for you and 800 more for your crew, to any who effected a capture. Perhaps it is more now. The decrees change, so many details. Formerly, we sent pirates back to Seville, where the Inquisition could encourage you to repent your sins and your heresy in the same breath. But that is so tedious. Now we send only the heads, and reserve our cargo space for more profitable wares.
Hunter said nothing.
Perhaps you are thinking, Kazala continued, that 200 doubloons is too modest a sum. As you may imagine, at this very moment I agree with you. But you enjoy the distinction of knowing that you are the most valued pirate in all these waters. Does that please you?
I take it, Hunter said, in the spirit it was intended. Kazala smiled.
I can see that you are born a gentleman, he said. And I wish to assure you that you shall be hanged with all the dignity of a gentleman. You have my word on that.
Hunter gave a small bow from his chair. He watched as Kazala reached across his desk for a small glass bowl with a fitted lid. Inside the bowl were broad green leaves. Kazala removed one of these leaves and chewed it thoughtfully.
You look puzzled, Englishman. This practice is unfamiliar to you? The Indians of New Spain call this leaf coca. It grows in the high country. To chew it brings energy and strength. For women, it provokes great ardor, he added, chuckling. You wish to taste for yourself? No? You are reluctant to accept my hospitality, Englishman?
He chewed a moment in silence, staring at Hunter. Finally, he said,
Have we not met before?
No.
Your face is strangely familiar. Perhaps in the past, when you were younger?
Hunter felt his heart pound. I do not think so.
No doubt you are right, Kazala said.
He stared thoughtfully at the painting on the far wall.
All Englishmen look alike to me. I cannot tell one from the next.
He looked back at Hunter.
And yet you recognized me. How can that be?
Your visage and manner are much known in the English colonies. Kazala chewed a bit of lime with his leaves. He smiled, then chuckled.
No doubt, he said. No doubt.
He abruptly wheeled around in his chair and slapped the table.
Enough! We have business to discuss. What is the name of your vessel?
Cassandra, Hunter said.
And who is her owner?
I am myself owner and captain.
And whence put you to sea?
Port Royal.
And for what reason did you make a sea voyage?
Hunter paused here. If he could have conjured up a plausible reason, he would have immediately said it. But it was not easy to explain the presence of his ship in these waters. Finally, he said, We were advised a slaver from Guinea would be found in these waters. Kazala made a clucking sound and shook his head.
Englishman, Englishman.
Hunter made his best show of reluctance. Then he said, We were making for Augustine. That was the most settled town in the Spanish colony of Florida. It had no particular riches, but it was at least conceivable that English privateers would attack it.
You chose an odd course, and a slow one.
Kazala drummed his fingers on the tabletop.
Why did you not sail west around Cuba? Into the Bahama Passage.
Hunter shrugged. We had reason to believe there were Spanish warships in the passage.
And not here?
The risk was better here. Kazala considered this for a long moment. He chewed noisily and sipped his wine.
There is nothing in Augustine but swamps and snakes, he said. And no reason to risk the Windward Passage. And in this vicinity,
he shrugged,
No settlement which is not strongly defended. Too strongly for your little boat and your puny crew.
He frowned.
Englishman, why are you here?
I have spoken the truth, Hunter said. We were making for Augustine.
This truth does not satisfy me, Kazala said.
At that moment, there was a knock at the door, and a seaman stuck his head into the cabin. He spoke rapidly in Spanish. Hunter knew no Spanish, but he had a little command of French, and with this knowledge he was able to deduce that the seaman was telling Kazala the sloop was manned with its prize crew and ready to sail. Kazala nodded and stood.
We sail now, he said. You come with me to the deck. Perhaps there are others in your crew who do not share your reluctance to speak.
Chapter 16
The privateers had been formed up in two ragged lines, their hands bound. Kazala paced up and down in front of the men. He held a knife in one hand and slapped the flat of the blade against the palm of his other hand. For a moment, there was complete silence, except for the rhythmic slap of steel on his fingers. Hunter looked away, to the rigging of the warship. She was making an easterly course, probably heading for the protection of Hawk's Nest Anchorage, south of Turk Isle. He could see, in the twilight, the Cassandra following on the same course a short distance behind the larger ship. Kazala interrupted his thoughts.
"Your captain," he said loudly, "will not tell me your destination." "He says it is Augustine," he said, with heavy sarcasm. "Augustine, a child could lie more convincingly. But I tell you, I will know your purpose. Which man of you will step forward and say?"
Kazala looked at the two lines of men. The men stared back at him with blank faces.
"Must I encourage you, eh?"
Kazala stepped close to one seaman.
"You, will you speak?"
The seaman did not move, did not speak, did not even blink. After a moment, Kazala resumed his pacing.
"Your silence means nothing," he said. "You are all heretics and brigands, and you will swing at the end of a rope in good time. Until that day, a man can either live comfortably or not. Any man who speaks shall live at his ease until the appointed day, and for that he has my solemn word."
Still, no one moved. Kazala stopped pacing.
"You are fools. You mistake my determination."
He was standing now in front of Trencher, clearly the youngest member of the privateer crew. Trencher trembled, but he held his head high.
"You, lad," Kazala said, his voice softening, "you do not belong in this rough company. Speak up, and tell me the purpose of your voyage."
Trencher opened his mouth, then closed it again. His lip trembled.
"Speak," Kazala said softly. "Speak, speak."
But the moment had passed. Trencher's lips were firm and tight together. Kazala watched him for a moment, and then with a single swift gesture, slit his throat with the knife in his hand. It happened so quickly Hunter hardly saw it. Blood poured in a broad red sheet down the boy's shirt. His eyes were wide with horror, and he shook his head slowly in a kind of disbelief. Trencher sank to his knees and remained there a moment, head bowed, watching his own blood drip onto the wood decking and onto the toes of Kazala's boots. The Spaniard stepped back with a curse. Trencher remained kneeling for what seemed an eternity. Then he looked up and gazed for an agonizing moment into Hunter's eyes. His look was pleading and confused and afraid. And then his eyes rolled upward and his body pitched flat onto the deck, and he gave a violent shiver. All the seamen were watching Trencher die, and yet no man moved. His body convulsed, his shoes making a scrabbling sound on the wood of the deck. Blood ran in a large pool around his face, and then finally he was still. Kazala had watched the death throes with utter absorption. Now he stepped forward, placed his foot on the dead boy's neck, and stamped hard. There was the crunch of breaking bones. He looked at the two lines of seamen.
"I shall know the truth," he said. "I swear to you I shall know it."
He spun to his first mate.
"Take them below and lock them," he said.
He nodded to Hunter.
"Take him with them."
And he strode off to the aft castle. Hunter was bound and taken below with the others. The Spanish warship had five decks. The upper two decks were gun decks. Some of the crew slept here in hammocks stretched between the cannon. Next were quarters for the soldiers. The fourth deck was given over to storage of shot, food, block and tackle, fittings, provisions, and livestock. The fifth and lowest deck was hardly a deck at all. It was barely 4 feet from the floor to the heavy beamed ceiling, and because this deck was below the waterline, there was no ventilation. The heavy air stank of feces and bilge. The Cassandra's crew was taken here. The men were made to sit on the rough floors, a little apart from each other. 20 soldiers were stationed as guards in corners of the room, and from time to time one would walk around with a lantern, examining each man's bonds to be certain they were not loosened. Talking was not permitted, nor was sleep, and any man who tried either was treated to a rough kick from a soldier's boot. The men were not allowed to move, and if they had to relieve themselves, they did so where they sat. With 60 men and 20 guards, the narrow, airless space soon became suffocating, hot, and fetid. Even the guards were soaked in sweat. There was no indicator of the passage of time. The only sounds were the heavy thumping movements of the livestock on the deck above, and the endless monotonous hiss of water as the warship sailed forward. Hunter sat in the corner, trying to concentrate on the sound of the water, waiting for it to cease. He tried to ignore the true desperateness of his condition. He and his crew were buried deep in the bowels of a mighty warship, surrounded by hundreds of enemy soldiers, utterly at their mercy. Unless Kazala anchored for the night, they were all